This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Tiara Fayan, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. For the week of November 13th, here are a few top stories. In the news, Hilldale, Utah is just across the state line from Colorado City, Arizona. Together, they make up the community called Short Creek. It's best known for being home to the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or FLDS. The polygamous sect has dominated the politics of the community since its inception, until now. In Hilldale's first municipal election since the towns were found guilty of religious discrimination in a lawsuit by the Justice Department last year, all of the winners are non-church members. Also, for the first time, a woman was elected mayor. KJZZ's Sarah Ventry reports on historic changes happening in Short Creek.
I need a grilled chicken.
It's 24 hours before the polls close, and mayoral candidate Danya Jessup is busy making burgers, wraps, and salads, while her husband Joe works the drive-thru at their new fast food restaurant and convenience store, The Hub. Jessup's mayoral campaign is historic. Not only is she a woman, but she's also an ex-church member, or in FLDS terminology, an apostate. According to church doctrine, leaving the faith means losing your salvation. It also means being shunned by your family and your community. Despite all of that, Jessup and lots of other people who left the church stayed or came back to town.
For the world to see that we are truly making a change in Hilldale, and the Hilldale is not the same place it used to be. To have a woman as mayor is a big statement.
Ex-church members say in previous elections, the church would decide who would run, and there would be no competition. But in this election, the non-FLDS candidates were voted on ahead of time in an unofficial primary of sorts. Half the candidates are FLDS, and half are not. That divide between church and non-church members exists in the community as well. Jessup says this election is especially personal for most people in town.
The people who are currently serving on the town council are our family members. So it's not like we're going up against strangers. We're going up against our uncles, our brothers, people that are highly respected, people who I respect.
Jared Nickel, who is running for city council, is a relative newcomer. He moved here 2.5 years ago from the Salt Lake area. And hours before the polls close, he's standing along the highway with his family. They're holding signs, waving, and trying to get passing cars and trucks to honk in support. Nickel says he feels like the current city council doesn't truly listen to the concerns of everyone in the community, and that the council operates differently than he thinks it should, which is what motivated him to run.
They do have different ways that you can give information, but it just seems that no one's really paying attention to what's coming in, that they just kind of have an agenda and that's what's going to get done.
Unlike Jessup, Nickel was never a church member. He is a member of the mainstream LDS or Mormon church, which has disavowed the practice of plural marriage or polygamy.
I would like to try to get on to the city council to help give it diversity, because I do believe that diversity is what helps get you the best product, you know, ultimately.
On this, you're going to put your last name first and then your first name.
Okay.
On election day, the town's only place to vote in person is relatively quiet. Only a handful of voters have come in, and in the same building as the votes are being cast sits the mayor.
So my name's Philip Barlow. I'm the mayor of Hilldale City.
Barlow is a member of the FLDS Church and was one of the key witnesses in the town's defense in the Department of Justice case last year. Listening to him now, he sounds like what many small-town mayors might sound like. His aspirations for the city, at least partially, are to make it feel the way it did in his childhood.
I've grown up in a small town, and I'd like to kind of keep it rural and keep it like it was when I grew up. And some of the changes are concerning to me, but, you know, that's kind of comes with growth. And so it's hard. Hard to kind of hold it back in some ways, but yet, you know, you want it to go the right direction.
Lots of people want the town to feel like it did when they were growing up. But depending on whether or not someone is still a part of the church, that vision can be very different. And there have been many controversies around this election, including who is even eligible to vote. Here's Jared Nickel.
And I realized that there was a handful of people registered to the address where I lived that had voted in the previous election when I lived there, and they were registered to my address.
So he and a handful of others in the community brought a list of a little more than 100 names to the county, people they believed weren't actually qualified to vote at the address where they were registered.
As of the end of the deadline for absentees, which was November 2nd, we had two voters who could actually prove that they actually resided within the district.
That's Melanie Aplinap, the Washington County Elections Supervisor. And 100 people is substantial in a city with only 368 registered voters. It's unclear why those people were still on the rolls and whether this was intentional or an honest mistake as a result of lots of movement and even evictions within the community. On election night, dozens of people show up at Jessup's house to watch the results come in. It's decorated in red, white, and blue, and people are snacking and drinking wine. And then...
Philip C. Bartle, 71. Donia Jessup, 96.
Jessup won. So did Jared Nickel. So did all of the non-FLDS candidates, which means for the first time ever, next year's council will include three councilors and a mayor who are not church members, and two councilors who are. And they have their work cut out for them. In addition to repairing the town physically, there's emotional labor to be done as well. Sarah Ventry, KJZZ News, reporting from Short Creek.
And we'll continue exploring the changes in Short Creek in the coming weeks to see a short documentary about the election and Donia's campaign, as well as see photos and hear voices from around the community. Visit kjzz.org/shortcreek. Now let's hear about a town you may know, but not in this way. Here's host Steve Goldstein from KJZZ's The Show.
When you hear the name Sedona, you undoubtedly think about a place with some good hiking spots and restaurants and red rocks and a vortex or two. But the city got its name at the turn of the 20th century from one of its residents, Sedona Schnebly. The new book, The Journal of Sedona Schnebly, was written by her great-granddaughter, Lisa Schnebly Heidinger.
The rocks seemed more three-dimensional than things back home. Then everywhere that wasn't taken up by those endless variations of stone was filled, festooned, decorated by green-growing things, and laid over all was the music of the water. Whatever fatigue remained was replaced by energy. I felt healed of some miasma I hadn't known I had. I was galvanized, grateful, and ready to begin.
Lisa, thanks for reading that. Now, let's revisit your direct connection to Sedona Schnebly.
Sedona Schnebly was my great-grandmother, and her husband came out with actually 2 weeks ahead of her, but they came out together basically in 1901, settled in Oak Creek on 80 acres, and he named the first post office, ergo the town, after her.
So how did the name Sedona come to her parents?
The classic family line is, her mama just made it up. I have wondered over the years, because apparently there is a Creole French name, Sedoni, S-E-D-O-N-I-E, if maybe her mother just outside St. Louis, Missouri, heard that, and it lodged in her brain, and she adapted it.
To consider the impact of what Sedona means to people now, and when you consider the history that you've looked into, how it's amazing how interspersed everything is, but thinking back to 1901 and thinking about what Sedona is now, what did you discover about the advances that what people perceive as Sedona and how it was in the early 20th century?
I think it's impossible, unless you live in Arizona, to realize how truly recent history is here. If she came out in 1901, Missouri had gas lamps. They were not far from getting automobiles. They had doctors, dress designers, you name it. And then you come here, and if there were five families in all of Oak Creek, it gets so dark there at night, even now. And my daughter, who we named Sedona, was with me recently when we were driving at night, and I said, it gets so dark here. And she pinpointed it. She said, it's like you're on a ship on the ocean at night. You don't know where the horizon is. And so to picture living there where there are no lights, I think I would have been nervous, possibly for years at night, because it got so dark here.
So what is it like, both creatively and spiritually, to channel this and to think about what this important person was and to try to, based on your family knowledge, based on research, but also based on just feel, what was that like as a creative person to put that together?
unlike anything I've ever done before. I don't know if you've ever had anybody take a nasal swab, but it reaches almost into your brain, and you think, I've never felt anything in that part of my body before. To write about her and to feel the stories come out, and then, I'm not saying it was a fugue state, mm-hmm. but I would definitely finish writing and think, wow, how about that? Over and over and over again. I had planned to do it my whole life since I was in my early 20s. I had written 33,000 savable words or adaptable words when I started this about a year ago. And in 3 months, it grew to 107,000. It just came out. Yeah. And I guess the longer something is seeping through the limestone of our brain and percolating and maybe fermenting and whatever else, it gets more gelled. But it just, I honestly felt like I learned things, Steve, writing it.
What made her a special person?
I think she had to have a stronger spirit of adventure than her early years would have indicated. Mm-hmm. To be a little girl in Gorin, Missouri, and go to the academy and learn elocution lessons and things, and then to turn your back on all of that and follow this man that you love out, marry him on your 20th birthday, and be willing to say goodbye to china closets and calling cards and corsets and everything else that back east held, and figure out at a very young age, I mean, from where I am, 22 is young, how to navigate an unspoiled wilderness, admittedly beautiful, but also lacking things. The first line of the book is, when I first saw the place that now shares my name, all I wanted to do was be somewhere else. Not that it wasn't lovely, uh-huh. she goes on to say, but I've been on a train for 4 days with a one-year-old and a three-year-old, and we're dirty and exhausted. There are no lights. There's no welcoming fire. There's a tent house. How many wilderness animals? All we have is Carl and his rifle, and just the sense of overwhelmed fatigue and desolation. Mm-hmm. She does the next morning go outside, look around, and feel really excited and knows herself fortunate to be in such a place.
How important do you think this story is in terms of telling sort of the broader state of what Arizona was before it was a state and then as it came to grow? I mean, even as just one key example, if we were just to zoom down and say this teaches us more about what Arizona was and what it became.
I think that the only reason her story is any more memorable than any other woman's pioneer story in Arizona is that now people go and they think, Sedona, either what funny name is that or who was she? Mm-hmm. And so because people are interested in what it was like for pioneer women at the turn of the 20th century, there's an opportunity to maybe tell all of their stories in some ways. And hers specifically. And certainly, one chapter that made me tired to write was when she was pregnant with her third child and how she would never let herself think that she deserves any particular break. But if another woman had gotten up, gotten the fire going, swept out the ashes, started the toast, turned it in time, gotten the children ready, fed the chickens, you know, before 7 a.m., I would think her day well begun, she says. And the amount of sheer work that would have taken is, I learned a lot writing that.
Lisa Schnebly-Heidinger is the author of the new book, The Journal of Sedona Schnebly, about her great-grandparents. Lisa, thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much.
This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. In business news, during peak snowy days, thousands of people from the valley make the two-hour climb to the small mountain town to experience winter. Flagstaff has a love-hate relationship with Phoenicians. The economic benefits are great, but the overcrowding causes serious problems. From Flagstaff, KJZZ's Laurel Morales reports.
Pretty soon, the already crowded Flagstaff streets are going to become bottlenecked with thousands more cars. On snowy holidays, Flagstaff sees an inpouring of as many as 10,000 more people seeking a winter wonderland experience. 1,500 of those will ski or snowboard at Arizona Snow Bowl off of Highway 180, especially now that they make their own snow. But the rest of the visitors are looking for sledding hills and snowmen. Most of those cars funnel onto the same two-lane highway north of town. Coconino County Sheriff Jim Driscoll recalls one particularly busy weekend last winter.
There were thousands and thousands of cars parked alongside the roads. The snowball ski area was at capacity, and we had officers up there responding to complaints of people coming onto private property, of minor traffic accidents, of vehicles blocking roadways.
At the same time, they had domestic violence calls, traffic accidents involving injuries, and a lost child. Driscoll says he only had four officers on duty to handle all of those calls in a county that's roughly the size of Switzerland. He says it doesn't matter if you're a deputy or an ambulance driver, you can't get through when it's gridlocked.
Our infrastructure will not support the kind of traffic that we are seeing. My belief is that we have overmarketed our capacity.
Driscoll says it's comparable to having just one road in and out of Cardinal Stadium on game day. If you closed off all of the other roads, it would take hours to clear. He says it's 22 potential holidays and weekend days out of the winter when out-of-town visitors come to Flagstaff. Many Flagstaff locals say the increased visitor traffic, along with new commercial and residential development, are pushing Flagstaff at the seams. Kat Shipley and Tekli Berhe are bartenders at Rendezvous in downtown Flagstaff.
Does the traffic affect you at all?
Yeah, I hate it.
It's awful.
Every day. It seems like it's getting way worse, you know?
The city's too small for such an influx of people.
Across the street, you'll hear a different take.
From a local's perspective, how can we be so selfish as to say that Flagstaff is all ours and everybody else stay out?
Lisa Lamberson owns Mountain Sports Outdoor Apparel and Brightside Bookshop.
From a business perspective, I am incredibly grateful that we have millions of people that live that close to us, that they come to our community and they support our restaurants and our retail locations and our hotels. It's a major part of our economy here in town.
The fact is, visitors support 8,000 jobs, and in 2016, Flagstaff's bed, board, and beverage tax, or BBB tax, brought in almost $7 million, according to the Convention and Visitors Bureau. Snowbowl General Manager J.R. Murray says since the resort started making snow 5 years ago, it's had a $40 million impact on the local economy per ski season.
So that includes employment and that includes sales tax, and certainly we see a boost and have since we've made snow in the BBB tax. And the winter receipts on that tax alone has increased every year since we started making snow.
Murray says Snowbowl has been able to stay open more than 100 days a year, with last year at an all-time high of 146 days. David Wessel is the manager for the Flagstaff Metropolitan Planning Organization.
Depending on your perspective, it's either, you know, Snowmageddon, where, you know, traffic is just going to be horrific all day long and you're going to be trapped in your home and not be able to get out of your neighborhood. Or it's the day where you're going to set sales records and make all kinds of money, you know, selling food, hotel rooms, plastic sleds.
Wessel and a county group have studied various solutions, from timing the traffic lights to building a bypass. He says there's a new snowplay area south of town that could divert traffic, but the snow is not consistent, and so far there are no plans to make snow there. Laurel Morales, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
In science news, here's KJZZ's Phil Latzman and Steve Goldstein.
I'm sure you've heard it before, but I'll say it again. There is a good chance that you have been hacked, whether you know it or not. One in three people have been hacked in the U.S., not to mention businesses small and large, losing important records to cyber breaches every day. The FBI says the total amount of ransom payments to these hackers approaches $1 billion annually.
Cybersecurity professionals are at the front lines in this fight, but there aren't enough of them. The research firm Cybersecurity Ventures estimates there will be 3.5 million unfilled cybersecurity jobs by 2021.
Grand Canyon University looked at that gap and decided to partner with the Arizona Cyber Warfare Range to open a new range on campus.
And what is a cyber warfare range stocked with but laptops and people willing to learn?
So we were doing social engineering, which is kind of like people hacking.
Anthony Brandt is an IT student at GCU. This is his first day in the range at GCU and his first time, as he put it, people hacking.
You search for a person's name based off of like an email or their name or birthday or something, and you try to find out as much as you can about them just using like Google and Facebook. We actually found an entire guy's family, including his parents' phone numbers and addresses, in a matter of like 15 minutes.
There are other GCU students too, but also folks from outside the school. Anyone can come learn these skills for free, just like they can at the range's other location in Mesa.
Skills like figuring out how easy it is to learn personal information about an individual.
So the question is, are they concerned they'll train someone who goes on to do the actual hacking instead of defending against hackers?
Brett Scott is the co-founder of Arizona Cyber Warfare Range, and his response is hackers can gain these skills for free elsewhere from other hackers, but also...
The difference is, if you come and learn it from us, if you want to be a bad guy or girl and you want to learn that from us, you have quite literally met the people that are going to help put you in jail.
And volunteers in the range believe that you can't fight hacking if you don't know how it works.
It's really hard to get hands-on experience, especially with the offensive side of things, because people are afraid. They don't want to put, you know, a loaded gun in your hands.
But that's exactly what volunteer Nick Flahiff says needs to happen. He also works as a security analyst.
That's the reason that, people are showing up for these jobs and they're unqualified. You know, they're trying to hop straight into defense, and they have no idea what these attacks looks like, how they're performed, you know, like really how an attacker's thinking.
He says a place that trains you to think like an attacker is rare. Flahiff actually learned all of this at the Mesa Range and says it's largely what got him the job he has now.
Now, as a volunteer here, he does things like hack into all the laptops in the room and crack passwords just to show everyone it's possible.
So this rig is able to do about 200 billion words per second. So, it's able to crack passwords basically in minutes.
It's a safe place for those learning to give it a go and then move on to jobs where they'll really know what they're up against and be able to stop it.
And the rest is up to the user. So, Phil, for example, have you changed your email password lately?
I'm doing that right now, Steve.
And you're listening to the show.
Thanks for listening to KJZZ. This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. In education news, while social media and smartphones can offer students expanded resources and opportunities to connect, they can also be a minefield for kids in their early teens. Schools across the country deal with problems related to cyberbullying and sexting on a daily basis. From the KJZZ Education Desk, Carrie Young drops in on one Valley school district that's trying to tackle the issue with a new set of classes.
If you ask Sonoran Trails Middle School principal Bill Dolezal to describe life in middle school, he'll tell you it's like one big learning experience. Kids that age are going to make mistakes, but he says today, especially with the omnipresence of social media and digital technology, policing those mistakes at his Cave Creek area school is getting much more complicated.
A couple years ago, we really had some students making poor choices with electronic devices.
From cyberbullying.
Saying things behind the safety of a screen that they wouldn't say to someone to their face.
To sexting.
Both verbal inappropriateness and then pictures being sent.
And Dolezal's experience isn't unique. According to the CDC, about 15% of high school students say they've been cyberbullied in the last year. And when you look at the issue of sexting, those numbers are even higher. In a 2014 survey by the American Academy of Pediatrics, more than 20% of high school students reported they've been involved in some form of sexually explicit instant messaging. A few years ago, Dolezal said he reached a breaking point, with a growing number of students being referred to his office for technology-related violations. But rather than looking to punishment, he decided to treat the whole thing as a learning experience and started working with a local psychologist who then developed an entire set of curriculum on the subject.
We talk about inappropriate posting, we talk about digital reputation, plagiarism, and then cyberbullying.
Lisa Strohman is the founder of what's now known as the Digital Citizens Academy.
What we're really proud of is the Diversion Program, which is really a program of when kids make the mistake, because they will online, how do we compassionately and responsibly give them options and help them get their way back to center?
Strohman is a psychologist based out of Scottsdale. She says teens' motivation to be relevant hasn't changed much over the years, but technology has changed the playing field.
So when I was in school, you know, I may have had 1,500 or 2,000 kids in my high school, let's say, that I was either known or not known, whatever clique I was in. Kids today now are competing against 3 million users online at any given time.
Today, a growing number of school districts nationwide are incorporating digital responsibility and awareness into their curriculums. For Principal Bill Dolezal, the move now feels like a natural step in evolving the school's general education standard curriculum. But he says the numbers are what really do the talking when it comes to discussing expanding these efforts beyond these middle school walls.
And our technology referrals went down by like 70%. It was dramatic how much of an impact it made.
He adds, while those numbers are encouraging, school officials know they can't get too comfortable because technology and the social media landscape are always changing. Carrie Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And finally, from the KJZZ Fronteras desk, the American Civil Liberties Union is accusing several state agencies of violating federal voting rights laws in Arizona. From the Fronteras desk in Phoenix, KJZZ's Matthew Casey reports the ACLU took the first step on Tuesday toward possible legal action.
Lawyers for the ACLU sent a notice to the Arizona Secretary of State's office alleging there are seven ways state agencies are breaking the National Voter Registration Act and the Voting Rights Act. One of them is failing to offer registration materials in languages spoken by minorities. Darrell Hill is a staff attorney with the ACLU of Arizona.
In our investigation, we visited several offices, and many of those offices did not have Spanish forms, and let alone forms in Native American languages.
Arizona Secretary of State Michelle Reagan released a statement saying she's reviewing the letter, will coordinate a meeting with the ACLU, and is confident the state will, quote, remain in full compliance with the National Voter Registration Act. Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by the Vitalist Health Foundation, the IEEE Foundation, the Cancer Treatment Centers of America, ASU Research, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.